Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. And I hope you're having a good weekend. I'm here to make it better, I guess, as we stand to reason, thinking about, talking about the most important things that we could possibly discuss, using the minds that God gave us to arrive, hopefully, at accurate and sound and good and right conclusions about those things. That's what the show is all about, Stand to Reason. And, of course, this is a show where you participate. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you're local to me here in Orange County, Southern California, the number direct is 754-4150. That's in the 714 area code. Once again, those numbers, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, dial direct, 754-4150. I will be very happy when the silly season is over with. Well, I'll be happy that it's over. That is the election season. I don't know I'll be happy when it's over. Depends how things turn out. But my personal interests aside, I think that when a person runs for office, that he should hold the views or policies that he holds with certain convictions. That is, the conviction that he thinks those views and policies are good, are right, and are true. And that's why he's representing them. That's why he wants to use the power in the office that he'll be elected to enforce those policies, justified because they're good and right and true. And if good, right, and true, then these are policies that one should be comfortable with shouting from the rooftops. And not, by contrast, hiding them, obfuscating, maybe confusing the issue so you don't see them clearly, or outright lying about those views that you actually personally represent, and therefore, since they're your personal convictions as a politician, they will affect your policy decisions. So in the interests of full disclosure here and informed consent, since you as a voter need to have full disclosure of the people you're voting for, and since you are giving consent to them to use their power to enforce their own convictions as policies in the government, then you ought to have a clear picture of what their policies are on the most important issues. And the most important justice issue that anyone faces right now, in my opinion, and I think if you are a follower of Christ, ought to be in your opinion, is the life of those that are unborn. And I do not think, at least with regards to one side, that there has been clarity on this issue. And so, in fact, when Senator Obama was asked specifically about this issue, abortion, at Rick Warren's kind of town hall meeting, whatever you want to call it, a couple months ago now, he said that regarding the question of when a human being gets human rights, he said philosophically, theologically, or otherwise, the answer to this question is above my pay grade. Which strikes me as a little odd since the president of the United States is the highest pay grade there is. But be that as it may, this is an expression at that point of uncertainty, which I think is misleading, because nothing that Senator Obama has ever done in his life or ruled in his life as a politician regarding this issue leaves any room for any ambiguity about his true conviction about when human beings receive their human rights. Not any time before birth, and in some cases not even after birth is the right answer to that. Now, if he really holds these convictions, he ought to shout those from the rooftops if he thinks they're right and true and good, but he doesn't. He hides these things. And so I want to take a moment here to read something to you. I've actually struggled with this, how I'm going to deal with this for a little bit, thinking about a piece that was written by Robert George entitled Obama's Abortion Extremism, something that Melinda Penner, the enforcer at Stand to Reason, in her blog post earlier this week under the same title, linked to Robert George. Of course, as many of you recognize this man as a high-level ethical thinker. He's at Princeton University. He's the director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institute and Institutions there at Princeton. He's on UNESCO's World Commission on Ethics and Scientific Knowledge and Technology. He's a senior fellow at the Witherspoon Institute of Princeton, New Jersey. And he is also on the serves on the President's Council of Bioethics. So this guy knows what he's talking about, and he's a very careful writer. Somebody I know, stand to reason, has been have interactions with him in the past. And I'm very happy to point you in the direction of the piece that he wrote. Now, this can't be summarized well. It is so good and so vital with regards to your understanding, making an informed decision with regards to this election, that I'm going to read it to you almost in its entirety. And here, Robert George specifically addresses the question, how can so many people, Roman Catholics, which he is, and Protestants who claim to be pro-life, be enamored with Barack Obama? They must not understand his views. And so he's written a paper that you can get on the internet, and there's a link to it, that outlines very specifically the views and history and actions and voting record of Barack Obama on anything that pertains to this issue. And I hope you're sitting down, because I think you will be stunned with what you're about to hear. Incidentally, I think you ought to get a copy of this. Go to the website, find the link on our blog post, get the document itself, download it, and send it to everybody you know who says they're pro-life, so that they can be properly informed. And here's what Robert P. George writes in his piece, Obama's Abortion Extremism. Barack Obama is the most extreme pro-abortion candidate ever to seek the office of President of the United States. He is the most extreme pro-abortion member of the United States Senate. Indeed, he is the most extreme pro-abortion legislator ever to serve in either house of the United States Congress. Yet there are Catholics and evangelicals, even self-identified pro-life Catholics and evangelicals, who aggressively promote Obama's candidacy and even declare him the preferred candidate from the pro-life point of view. What is going on here? I have examined the arguments, and this here is Robert George, I have examined the arguments advanced by Obama's self-identified pro-life supporters, and they are spectacularly weak. It is nearly unfathomable to me that those advancing them can honestly believe what they're saying. But before proving my claims about Obama's abortion extremism, let me explain why I have described Obama as pro-abortion rather than pro-choice. According to the standard argument for the distinction between these labels, nobody's pro-abortion. Everybody would prefer a world without abortions. After all, what woman would deliberately get pregnant just to have an abortion? But given the world as it is, sometimes women find themselves with unplanned pregnancies at times in their lives when having a baby would present significant problems for them. So even if abortion is not medically required, it should be permitted, made as widely available as possible, and when necessary, paid for with taxpayers' money. That's the point of view he's going to critique now, and he does that next. Robert George continues, the defect in this argument can easily be brought into focus if we shift to the moral question that vexed an earlier generation of Americans, slavery. Many people at the time of the American founding would have preferred a world without slavery, but nonetheless opposed abolition. Such people, Thomas Jefferson was one, reasoned that given the world as it was, with slavery woven into the fabric of society, just as it had often been throughout history, the economic consequences of abolition for society as a whole and for owners of plantations and other businesses that relied on slave labor would be dire. Many people who argued in this way were not monsters, but honest and sincere, albeit profoundly mistaken. Some, though not Jefferson, showed their personal opposition to slavery by declining to own slaves themselves or freeing slaves whom they had purchased or inherited. They certainly didn't think anyone should be forced to own slaves. Still, they maintained that slavery should remain a legally permitted option and be given constitutional protection. Now Robert George asks this question. Would we describe such people as pro-slavery or pro-choice? Of course you would not. as pro-choice. It wouldn't matter to us that they were personally opposed to slavery or that they wished that slavery were unnecessary or that wouldn't dream of forcing anyone to slow in slaves. We would hoot at the faux sophistication of a placard that said, against slavery? Don't own one. We would observe that the fundamental divide is between people who believe that law and public power should permit slavery and those who think that owning slaves is an unjust choice that should be prohibited. Now, just for the sake of argument, though, let us assume that there could be a morally meaningful distinction between being pro-abortion and being pro-choice. Who would qualify for the latter description, pro-choice? Barack Obama certainly would not, for unlike his running mate, Joe Biden, Obama does not think that abortion is a purely private choice that public authority should refrain from getting involved in. Now, Senator Biden is hardly pro-life. He believes that the killing of the unborn should be legally permitted and relatively unencumbered. But unlike Obama, at least Biden would not use taxpayer dollars to fund abortion, therefore leaving Americans free to choose not to implicate themselves in it. Very important distinction, ladies and gentlemen. He continues, if we stretch things to create a meaningful category called pro-choice, that Biden might be a plausible candidate for the label, at least he respects your choice or mine not to facilitate deliberate feticide. The same cannot be said for Barack Obama. For starters, he has promised to seek repeal of the Hyde Amendment, which has for many years protected pro-life citizens from having to pay for abortions that are not necessary to save the life of the mother and are not the result of rape or incest. The abortion industry laments that this long-standing federal law, according to the pro-abortion group NARAL, quote, forces about half the women who would otherwise have abortions to carry unintended pregnancies to term and bear children against their wishes instead, close quote. In other words, Robert George writes, in other words, a whole lot of people who are alive today would have been exterminated in utero were it not for the Hyde Amendment. Obama has promised to reverse the situation so that abortions that the industry complains are not happening because the federal government is not subsidizing would happen. And that is why people who profit from abortion love Obama even more than they do his running mate. But this barely scratches the surface of Obama's extremism. He has promised that the first thing, and this is a quote, the first thing I do as president is sign the Freedom of Choice Act, close quote, known as FOCA, F-O-C-A. This proposed legislation would create federally guaranteed fundamental right to abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, including, as Cardinal Justin Regali of Philadelphia has noted in a statement condemning the proposed act, a right to abort a fully developed child in the final weeks for undefined health reasons. In essence, FOCA would abolish virtually every existing state and federal limitation on abortion, including parental consent and notification laws for minors and conscience protections for pro-life citizens working in the healthcare industry. In other words, if you don't want to give an abortion, you shouldn't be allowed to do that. That will abolish that safety precaution, essentially. The Pro-Abortion National Organization for Women has proclaimed with approval that FOCA would sweep away hundreds of anti-abortion laws and policies. And it gets worse. Obama, unlike many pro-choice legislators, opposed the ban on partial birth abortions. And he condemned the Supreme Court decision that upheld legislation banning this heinous practice. He has referred to a baby conceived inadvertently by a young woman as a punishment that she should not endure. He has stated that women's equality requires access to abortion on demand. Appallingly, he wishes to strip federal funding from pro-life crisis pregnancy centers that provide alternatives to abortion for pregnant women in need. Did you hear that? He wants to take money away from CPCs that help women who choose to carry their child. There's certainly nothing pro-choice about that, Robert George writes. But it gets even worse. When pro-life members of Obama's own party in Congress proposed the so-called 9510 legislation to strengthen the social safety net for poor women, and they hoped, reduce the number of abortions by 95% in 10 years, Obama refused to support it. This legislation would not have made a single abortion illegal. It simply sought to make it easier for pregnant women to make the choice not to abort their babies. Here was a concrete test of whether Obama was pro-choice rather than pro-abortion. He flunked. Then he flunked again by opposing the inclusion of unborn children in the state's state children's health insurance program, which would have helped to save unborn babies without making abortion illegal. Many implacably pro-choice members of Congress, like Edward Kennedy, supported that, but Barack Obama stood resolutely with the most stalwart abortion advocates in opposing it. And it gets worse yet. In an act of breathtaking injustice, which the Obama campaign lied about, until critics produced documentary proof of what had been done, as an Illinois state senator, Obama opposed legislation to protect children who are born alive, either as a result of an abortionist's unsuccessful effort to kill them in the womb, or by the deliberate delivery of the baby prior to viability. This legislation would not have banned any abortions. Indeed, it included specific provision ensuring that it did not affect abortion laws. This is what Obama and his campaign lied about until they were caught. The federal version of the bill passed unanimously in the United States Senate, winning the support of such ardent advocates of legal abortion as John Kerry and Barbara Boxer, but Barack Obama opposed it and worked to defeat it. For him, a child marked for abortion gets no protection, even ordinary medical or comfort care, even if she is born alive and entirely separate from her mother. So Obama has favored protecting what is literally a form of infanticide. You may be thinking, it can't get worse than that, but it does, Robert George writes. For several years, Americans have been debating the use of biomedical research of embryos produced in vitro fertilization. In other words, originally for reproductive purposes, but now left in a frozen condition in cryopreservation units. President Bush has restricted the use of federal funds for stem cell research of the type that makes use of these embryos and destroys them in the process. Here Robert George says, I support the president's restriction, but some legislators with excellent pro-life records, including John McCain, argue that the use of federal money should be permitted where the embryos are going to be discarded or die anyway as a result of the parent's decision. Senator Obama, too, wants to lift the restriction. But Obama would not stop there. He has co-sponsored a bill. So this is one of the things he's actually doing. He's co-sponsoring a bill strongly opposed by McCain that would authorize the large-scale industrial production of human embryos for use in biomedical research in which they would be killed. In fact, the bill Obama co-sponsored would require the killing of human beings in the embryonic stage that were produced by cloning. And it would make it a federal crime for a woman to save an embryo by agreeing to have the tiny developing human being implanted in her womb so that he or she could be brought to term. This clone and kill bill would, if enacted, bring something to America that has heretofore existed only in China, the equivalent of legally mandated abortion. In an audacious act of deceit, Obama and his co-sponsors misleadingly called this an anti-cloning bill. But it is nothing of the kind. What it bans is not cloning, but allowing the embryonic children produced by cloning to survive. Now, just as an aside here, friends, I've mentioned in the past, all cloning is cloning. There's only one kind of cloning. Even though there are different terms to describe, like reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning, in therapeutic cloning, they clone, they just kill the clone and use it for therapy. In the case of reproductive cloning, they allow the clone to live. But both are cloning. And Obama's used the sleight of hand, as many have, of cloning and then killing the embryo and saying, or promoting the cloning and killing of the embryo and saying, well, this isn't really cloning because we kill the embryo pretty quickly to use it for research. And that's a lie. Continuing on with Robert George, I think we're going to skip our break so I can finish this and get to calls. Robert George writes, can it get still worse? Yes. Decent people of every persuasion hold out the increasingly realistic hope of resolving the moral issue surrounding embryonic stem cell research by developing methods to produce the exact equivalent of embryonic stem cells without using or producing embryos. But when a bill was introduced in the United States Senate to put a modest amount of federal money into research to develop these methods, Barack Obama was one of the few senators who opposed it. From any rational vantage point, this is unconscionable. Why would someone not wish to find a method of producing the pluripotent cells scientists want that all Americans could enthusiastically endorse? Why create and kill human embryos when there are alternatives that do not require the taking of nascent human lives? It is as if Obama is opposed to stem cell research unless it involves killing human embryos. This ultimate manifestation of Obama's extremism brings us back to the puzzle of his pro-life Catholic and evangelical apologists, that is, those who defend him. They typically do not deny the facts I have reported. They could not. Each one is a matter of public record. But despite Obama's injustices against the most vulnerable human beings, and despite the extraordinary support he receives from the industry that profits from killing the unborn, which should be a good indicator of where he stands, some Obama supporters insist that he is the better candidate from the pro-life point of view. Robert George continues, they say that his economic and social policies would so diminish the demand for abortion that the overall number would actually go down, despite the federal subsidizing of abortion and the elimination of hundreds of pro-life laws. The way to save lots of unborn babies, they say, is to vote for the pro-choice candidate. They tell us not to worry that Obama opposes the Hyde Amendment or the Mexico City policy against funding abortion abroad, that he's against parental consent notification laws, that he's against conscience protections and the funding of alternatives to embryo destructive research. They ask us to look past his support for Roe versus Wade, the Freedom of Choice Act, partial birth abortion, and human cloning and embryo killing. An Obama presidency, they insist, means less killing of the unborn. This, Robert George writes, is delusional. We know that the federal and state pro-life laws and policies that Obama has promised to sweep away and that John McCain would protect save thousands of lives every year. The rigorous studies conducted by Professor Michael New and other social scientists have removed any doubt. By the way, this is another place where Obama lied. He said abortion has gone up over the years. It has not. It has gone down because of these laws. Anyway, I continue with Robert George's article. In some cases, as we have seen, even the abortion lobby confirms the truth of what these scholars have determined. Nor can we ignore the effect of the message that Obama and his policies would send, that abortion is a legitimate solution to the problem of unwanted pregnancies, so clearly legitimate that taxpayers should be forced to pay for it. But for a moment, let's just suppose, against all the evidence, that Obama's proposals would reduce the number of abortions, even while subsidizing the killing with taxpayer dollars. Even so, many more unborn human beings would likely be killed under Obama than under McCain. Here's why. A Congress controlled by strong Democratic majorities under Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi would enact the bill authorizing the mass industrial production of human embryos by cloning for research in which they are killed. As president, Obama would sign it. And why wouldn't he? It's part of his own legislation. The number of tiny humans created and killed under this legislation, and that's assuming that an efficient human cloning technique is soon to be perfected, could dwarf the number of lives saved as a result of the reduced demand for abortion, even if we take a delusionally optimistic view of what that number would be. Barack Obama and John McCain, and now he moves into his conclusion, Barack Obama and John McCain differ on many important issues about which reasonable people of goodwill, including pro-life Americans of every faith, disagree. How best to fight international terrorism, how to restore economic growth and prosperity, how to distribute the tax burden and reduce poverty, etc. But on abortion and the industrial creation of embryos for destructive research, there is profound difference of moral principle, not just prudence. These questions reveal the character and judgment of each man. Barack Obama is deeply committed to the belief that members of an entire class of human beings have no rights that others must respect. Across the spectrum of pro-life concerns for the unborn, he would deny these tiny members of the human family the basic protection of the laws. Over the next 4 to 8 years, as many as 3 U.S. Supreme Court justices are likely to retire. Obama enthusiastically supports Roe v. Wade and would appoint judges who would protect the morally and constitutionally disastrous decision and even expand its scope. Indeed, in an interview in Glamour magazine, he promised to apply a litmus test for Supreme Court nominations. Jurists who do not support Roe will not be considered for appointment by Obama. John McCain, by contrast, opposes Roe and would appoint judges likely to overturn it. And that's because John McCain's judicial philosophy is not activist, but it's conservative. Original intent, and you're not going to find the right to abortion in the text. In any event, I digress. Back to Robert George's comments here in Obama's, in the piece that he wrote entitled Obama's Abortion Extremism. He says this would not make abortion illegal, but it would return the issue to the forum. That is, if John McCain selected judges that were conservative and they ruled against Roe, this would not make abortion illegal, but it would return the issue to the forums of democratic deliberation where pro-life Americans could engage in a fair debate to persuade fellow citizens that killing the unborn is no way to address the problems of pregnant women in need. And his final paragraph, Robert George, what kind of America do we want our beloved nation to be? Barack Obama's America is one in which being human just isn't enough to warrant care and protection. It is an America where the unborn may legitimately be killed without legal restrictions, even by the grisly practice of partial birth abortion. It is an America where a baby who survives abortion is not even entitled to comfort care as she dies on a stainless steel table or in a soiled linen bin. And there he's referring to Barack Obama's unwillingness to vote for the Baby Born Alive Act in Illinois. It is a nation in which some members of the human family are regarded as inferior and others superior in fundamental dignity and rights. In Obama's America, public policy would make a mockery of the great constitutional principle of the equal protection of the laws. And perhaps the most telling comment made by any candidate in either party in this election year, Senator Obama, when asked by Rick Warren when a baby gets human rights, replied, "That question is above my pay grade." It was a profoundly disingenuous answer, Robert George writes. For even at a state senator's pay grade, Obama presumed to answer that question with blind certainty. His unspoken answer then, as now, is chilling. Human beings have no rights until infancy, and if they are unwanted survivors of attempted abortions, not even then. In the end, the efforts of Obama's apologists to depict their man as the true pro-life candidate that Catholics and evangelicals may and even should vote for doesn't even amount to a nice try. Voting for the most extreme pro-abortion political candidate in American history is not the way to save unborn babies. Robert P. George, McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. The piece is Obama's Abortion Extremism. And just one final comment before we go to commercial. It seems to me, based on what Robert George has written, the lesson is this. If you are radically pro-choice, Obama is your man. But if you think that abortion in all its forms, the garden variety of abortion, plus partial birth abortion, plus large-scale production and destruction of embryos for embryonic stem cell research, plus allowing babies who survive abortion to die, plus having the government pay for all of this with your tax dollars. If you think this is wrong because of the wanton destruction of defenseless human life, then it seems to me you better invest your vote elsewhere. And if you believe God cares about these things, I don't know how you can vote for Obama and then stand before God and say, I made the good, right, moral choice. I voted for your your man on this, Lord. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes in that circumstance. This is Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Back in a moment. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Show Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm Greg Kokel. I just gave you a lot of good reason to vote for one candidate or the other on the most important issue of justice that we face, the issue of abortion. And in the interest of informed consent, I gave you a clear idea of where both candidates stand on this issue, and you make your own decision. Please, please, please go to str.org, go to the blog section, find Melinda's post, Obama's Abortion Extremism. Go to the link to Robert George's article, download it, and send it out so that people are properly informed of what they're voting for if they choose to vote for Barack Obama, and that, of course, is their choice. If this is what they want and this is what they believe in, vote for him. But if they don't believe in that, and they think that, as I mentioned, abortion in all its forms is desperately evil, then don't vote for the man who will do everything he possibly can to promote it. All right, to the phones. Let's go to Ohio, and Chris, welcome to Stand to Reason, and thank you for waiting.
Oh, that's no problem. My question is, and maybe I have your view wrong on this, but about predestination.
Uh-huh.
If God chooses who is to be saved, is it possible then that a person could basically like be seeking God, but because he isn't selected, he's knocking on a door that will never answer?
No, it's not possible. But it is not possible that God would deny salvation to a non-elect person.
Really? Cause, I mean, I guess that, and I haven't listened like to everything that you put out. I just got the ambassador's
right. Well, let me qualify. Let me explain what I mean. And this is sure. I put it that way because that's an accurate way of putting it. But my answer is driven by a certain conviction. And so, and when I answer this, I think that maybe you, I hope that maybe you'll see this issue from a little different perspective, because a lot of times when people hear about election, they think about all those poor people who want to get in heaven and God is denying them because he doesn't want them. And that is not the case. If the question is, can a non-elect person be denied salvation? My answer is no, because someone can only be denied what he asks for or seeks.
Okay.
No non-elect person is going to ask for salvation or even seek salvation on God's terms, and therefore he cannot be denied such a thing, because you can't be denied something you don't ask for. It will not be gained by them, but they will not be saved. The fact that they will not be saved is not because they were not elect, but is because they chose to rebel persistently and consistently against God. And then God is going to give them their just deserts, and that is judgment for their rebellion. And this is something that people don't understand. Election is the solution. It isn't the problem. Were it not for election, no one would be saved, given the fallen condition of man. Everyone would be condemned, because everyone not only is guilty and has sinned against God, but according to the scriptures, and this is very clear in a number of places, and Romans 3 is the most clear place, though Romans 1 gives us some indication.
Right.
What Romans 3 says is, there is none that seeks God, not even one. And here he's speaking, I think, in unambiguous and unequivocal terms, because this is part of his argument for the cross. Now, there are other passages that talk about godly men and people seeking God, but I think those have to be understood in light of the qualifications that Paul offers here. That is, anyone who is, who we notice seeking God and we can identify seeking God, are only seeking God because of something that God has done in them already to overcome their rebellion and turn them towards him. And so when we see scripture speaking about people seeking God, I think it's describing the result of God's working in their life. And that's why Jesus himself says, no one can come to me unless the Father draws him. That's in John chapter 6.
Okay.
And then in the more detailed theological analysis that we see in Romans, particularly in chapter 3, we realize that underneath everything is a core rebellion against God, such that as men look up to see the greatness of God in the creation, that their response is not to worship him as God, but rather they suppress the truth in unrighteousness, that is, in their rebellion, and they worship the creature rather than the creator. And Paul describes two chapters later, in more detail, that there is no one who actually seeks after God. There is not even one. And this is what necessitates the action of God graciously reaching out to us. In Romans 5, it says that we didn't seek God, we didn't love God. Even while we were yet sinners, he loved us. He took the initiative. He came to us. He drew us. He called us. So it is not the case that there are all these other people out there that are looking for God, seeking salvation on God's terms. I'm not saying there aren't people that wouldn't say they are. I'm saying that from God's perspective, they are not seeking on his terms, and but are being denied salvation that they seek because they are not the elect. That just isn't happening. Instead, all are running from God, and then God reaches out to save some by an act of grace that is not deserved. Now, I've been doing a lot of the talking here, Chris. You may disagree with me, and that's okay. But I think getting clarity, at least on my view here, is what's critically important.
Right. I've actually growing up, I was kind of a staunch, definitely against the idea of because I respect your other views and stuff on your in your analysis, I figure I'd give it, I guess, a rigorous run through of what all it entails and maybe give it some consideration.
Yeah, there are some things that I've done on this on the show that we've transcribed and we have on the website, and you can look that up. I think I have a piece called Irresistible Grace. What is that? Well, Melinda's on the phone. I'll have to give it to you on the air. Well, you're in Ohio, so if you hang up, you won't hear me. But I'll try to repeat something I did a couple 6 months ago that was on I can put you on hold. All right, why don't I maybe I'll do that, Chris. And then after the break, which is just coming up, I will ask the enforcer the title of the piece on the website that will give you more understanding of how this works. It's a written piece, so you can pore over it and think about it a little bit more. Would that be all right?
All right. Yeah, that's fine.
All right, Chris. Hang on. I'm going to put you on hold, and then I'm going to go to break. And then in the next segment, I'll mention the piece. You'll hear it, and then we'll send you back and make room for someone else. All right?
All right.
All right, Chris. Thanks a lot. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. I'll be coming back in just a moment with more.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
All right, we're back with you at Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 3 to 5. Now, we're still looking for that piece. And I'm going to keep you on hold there, Chris. Let's see. Is this it right here? It's called Sovereign Grace and Free Choice. That's it. Yeah. Sovereign Grace and Free Choice. Sovereign Grace and Free Choice. So if you look that up on our website, you'll probably have to register to get it, but I suspect you, Chris, are already... No, you don't? Okay. Well, anybody can get it. Registration just means that, you know, you give them your name and, you know, you sign up and get a password, and then you can get everything, not just some of the things. But this one's available for anyone. So there you go, Chris. And thanks so much for you. You want to dump Chris there on that side? Coming up next, let me see. Yeah, within about a week here, October 26th, William Dembski and Sean McDowell are doing a conference called Understanding Intelligent Design. That's going to be at Capistrano Valley. Is that their church? It's in San Juan Capistrano. It's on October 26th from 6 to 8 p.m. Now, William Dembski, by the way, you probably recognize that name if you follow this issue at all, is in a sense, one of the founding fathers of the intelligent design movement. He's written quite a number of books on this, and he's very, very clear on this issue. And Sean has worked with him on a book dealing with the issue. They're having a conference coming up this week, this next weekend, I guess, October 26th. And if you'd like to go, let me give you the website. It's the simplest way to do it. CVCS.org. CVCS.org. That would be Capel Valley Christian School, I guess what it stands for, CVCS. But anyway, they're great conferences, and I hope you can attend. In fact, we're going to have a table there. I won't be there, but we will have a table there. All right. Let's go to Costa Mesa and Debbie. Debbie, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Oh, am I on?
That's you, Deb.
Oh, okay. This is what I wanted to ask you. I was listening to your editorial about abortion, comparing it to slavery. What verses in the Bible outlaws where God condemned slavery?
First, let me just clarify. The point that was being made by Robert George that I was reading was not really about the biblical case against slavery, but about the term pro-choice, that if a person had views in which they did not personally believe in slavery for themselves, but said it should be legal for other people to own slaves, you would not call those people pro-choice. You would call them pro-slavery, which is exactly what we did. And so therefore, nowadays, when people, even though they wouldn't themselves maybe have an abortion, when they think that abortion is an appropriate choice for an unborn child, those people should be called pro-abortion and not simply pro-choice. And that matter stands regardless, it seems to me, regardless of what the scriptures teach or don't teach about slavery. Okay?
Now, also, but is there any scriptures that condemn slavery? Because, I mean, I was just curious. I wanted to look it up. But
yeah, there are no scriptures that I know of that directly condemn slavery per se as an institution. And there's a reason for this. Let me say two things. First of all, and I could be mistaken about this fact about the scriptures, I'm just saying this is my knowledge. And the conclusions that people come to about slavery ultimately being non-Christian are based on principles the scripture teaches, not on direct prohibitions of slavery. Instead, what you have in the scripture is restraint and restriction and ennobling of what was then a heinous practice of slavery and promoting more of an indentured servant kind of system in the Old Testament. And but it doesn't promote the kind of human beings being owned concept that we see in early American history and British history when the slave trade was going forward. But rather what we see there, the abolitionists argued, was directly contrary to a biblical principle. And the principle is that human beings are made in the image of God, and this is taught in Genesis 1, for example, and also in Genesis 9, which is why we can't kill one another, because if we shed man's blood, then by man our blood should be shed, because in the image of God, God created man. And in virtue of the fact that God made man in his image, then we are obliged to treat human beings consistent with being made in the image of God, and slavery, as practiced by the colonies and Great Britain and elsewhere in the world, as opposed to indentured servanthood, slavery was inconsistent with that principle. And this is how they argued against it.
Okay, now what about abortion? Is there any specific scriptures that says life begins at conception? I mean, you know, in the Old or New Testament?
No, there aren't any specific scriptures that say life begins at conception. We know when human life begins because of our scientific knowledge, all right? But once again, we have scriptural information that allows us to draw conclusions about this issue. So we ask the question, what does the scripture teach about the value of human beings? And specifically in the Ten Commandments, the scripture says that we should not murder. And we see the statement I mentioned earlier in Genesis 9, even before the law was given, that apart from the Mosaic law, it's wrong to take human life in an unjustified way because human beings are made in the image of God. OK, Okay? So we shouldn't be murdering human beings made in the image of God.
Okay.
Wait, I didn't finish yet. Let me just finish my point.
No,
that's quite all right, and I'll let you respond, but I want to make the case, okay? Now, if human beings have intrinsic value because they're made in the image of God, then when does a human being become a human being? Well, a human being is, you are yourself when you come into existence, and then you develop after that. Whether you're developing in the womb or outside of the womb, your location doesn't seem to be a relevant factor. And so it seems that if you're valuable as a human being 1 minute after you are born, all you did was move from one location to another to be born, so you were just as valuable as a human being when you were in the womb as you are after you're outside of the womb. Now, in fact, we have something like that. It seems an indication of that from some Bible verses. Because if you remember in Luke 1 or 2, it says there that John the Baptist will be filled with the Holy Spirit while he's still in his mother's womb. Now, if you remember that when Mary, Jesus' mother, went to visit her cousin Elizabeth, who was the mother of John the Baptist, it says she was in her sixth month, in other words, her second trimester at the end of it. And then when she came into contact with Mary, who at that time was carrying Jesus, and Jesus was, you know, just been conceived at that point, when John the Baptist, 6 months in the womb of Elizabeth, encountered Jesus just newly in the womb of Mary, John the Baptist jumped with joy, the scripture says, and was filled with the Holy Spirit. Now, it seems to me that occasion is enough information to show us that God sees the unborn, in that case, the unborn John the Baptist, and the unborn Jesus, as the very same ones that were later the ones who were born and with the same value. They're just smaller and less developed, but they are still the human beings that can be filled with the Spirit and can influence each other supernaturally in that way. And so these are some biblical indications that we ought to think of the unborn as valuable just as those who are born. Okay, your turn.
Okay, I just have two more questions, because I agree with you on abortion.
Yes. Does that make sense, what I just said?
Yeah, it makes sense, but the thing that bothers me in reading the Old Testament, where God orders, I think it's in Joshua and in some of the books of Moses, orders infants to be killed.
Yes.
And I have a problem with that. When I read it, I just cringe, and I just think, how could God order little babies to be killed?
I got you, Debbie. That's actually, I don't think I'm going to have time to explain and defend that issue right now, but I just want to point out that that is an issue that is entirely different from the abortion issue. Because in that case, you have children that are born. And he is not making open season on children that are born. He is simply saying that they should go in and destroy this group of people, the Canaanites, for example, that had filled up their wrath before God over a long term of God's patience. And he said, wipe out the entire population. There is a legitimate question as to why God could allow such a thing. I can't deal with that now. There's not enough to, but I can enough time to. But I just want to point out that is a separate issue of whether it's okay for us to kill the unborn in a wanton fashion while still in the womb. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. And I just want to ask one more question,
right,
then I'll let you go.
Okay.
Are most of the people that'll be in heaven unborn fetuses?
I don't know.
Because if life begins at conception,
right,
people using the birth control pill and they're aborting fetuses and then all the miscarriages, wouldn't the majority of people that are in heaven that are saved be unborn fetuses?
If those who are killed before or who die before the age of consent, before they're able to know right from wrong, go to heaven, as I believe, then arguably there are going to be more, at least right now, more of those kinds of people in heaven than adults.
But I mean, throughout history, even with just miscarriages where the baby, you know, there's no abortion, it's just a regular miscarriage. I mean, aren't they, they're human beings too?
Yes, of course they would be. Well, if those children do go to heaven, then those would. That's a separate discussion. I think they do for separate reasons. But at this point in time, it seems there are probably more people who died before the age of consent than who died afterwards with proper faith and confidence and trust in God. Now, towards the end, this may may not be the case, because it may turn out that there's massive change, and around the world, hundreds of thousands and millions and maybe billions of adult people, or after the age of consent people, with their faith and their trust in the Messiah that God sent for them, and that ratio might change. But at this point, you may have a good point.
Oh, that may be the case. Okay, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I'm very glad to do so, and I thank you for calling. That ends a kind of whirlwind hour. We've got 1 hour ahead of us, so stay with us on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Sound like my 3-year-old, is it? Was it? No, I'm just like her. Greg Kokel here, hour number 2 on Stand to Reason. And I am with you every weekend for open discussion of contemporary ethical issues, things that really matter here, and also defense of classical Christianity and Christian values. I would be making that defense, or helping you to make that defense with others. And you can call me, of course, because I welcome your questions, your comments, your rejoinders, or rebuttals. 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, the number 754-4150. I started our first segment today by reading virtually the entire analysis of Senator Obama's abortion position, written by Robert George, entitled Obama's Abortion Extremism. I'm not going to go back over that information now, except to say that if you heard that and you were not stunned, particularly if you were a pro-lifer, if you were not stunned by what you heard, then that surprises me. Because every time I go over this, I'm slack-jawed almost. It's unbelievable to me. Now, if you missed it, you need to go to our website at str.org. You need to find Melinda's blog last week, entitled Obama's Abortion Extremism. Find the link there to Robert George's article and download it and read it, and then send it to your friends. Now, I think for the purposes of this show, people can vote for whoever they want to, and they should vote for the person who best they think represents their view. But you only know whether a person best represents your view if you know their view as well as your own and see that there's a match. And this is one of those views that I think that Obama has not only tried to confuse or obscure, but has actually lied about. But he can't get away with it in the long run because his record is a matter of record. And though he might smooth talk himself before audiences who then believe his smooth talk with regards to this issue, when it comes to the record, you can't obliterate the record, and the record says something different than what he says. His actions speak louder than his words and speak differently than his words. So if you are going to vote, and you ought to, and if you're a follower of Christ and don't shame on you, you ought to vote in a way that's consistent with your conscience. And if you are a follower of Christ, your conscience should be informed by Jesus' worldview. And therefore, this issue ought to be of paramount importance. And therefore, you need to know what both candidates believe on this issue. Then you could make your choice. And Senator McCain's point of view is unambiguous. And Senator Obama's is obfuscated to the extreme. And Robert George brings clarity to that. And you need to know the details on that. And so does every pro-life Christian of any denomination who is attracted to Senator Obama for other reasons. All right? That's all I'm going to say about that. Let's go to Dallas. And Scott, welcome to Stand to Reason. Scott, Greg Kokel, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
Good. Glad you called.
I have a question that you've talked about before, and you said some things that have been helpful in helping me think through it, but I'm still missing part of it. And that
okay.
is how we determine which of the Old Testament laws apply to us now, especially mm-hmm. looking at some of the Levitical things,
right.
that kind of stuff. And so two things that you've mentioned in the past. One, you had given an analogy about how, you know, we might be under a law in the state of Texas that running a stop sign is against the law, but that mm-hmm. has nothing to do with the fact that it's still against the law in California. It's because we're in Texas, not because of California.
That's right. If you're in Texas and you run a stop sign, you're breaking the Texas law. You're not breaking the California law, even though you may have the same details in each state. And but there are some things that might be illegal in California that you're free to do in Texas.
Right.
And so there is a parallel here, I think. And this isn't my illustration. It comes from a rabbi whose last name is, I think it's Fruchtenbaum. That would be Fruchtenbaum. Ariel Ministries, A-R-I-E-L, Ariel Ministries, I think is his organization. And I read a piece there that was consistent in general with my views, but in a sense stated my views more clearly than I could myself. And so that helped me to refine my views on this issue. And so he used the illustration to point out that even though in the New Testament we are not under the law of the Jews, there still may be moral obligations under the New Testament law, if you will, the law of Christ, that are the same kinds of moral obligations that Jews had for a different reason, that is, under the law of Moses. And I think when we see the obligations that are the same in the New Testament as under the law of Moses, we mistakenly assume that we are under the law of Moses at least in part. And this is what he and I would argue against.
Right, right. And so that piece clarified a lot.
You read that?
Yes.
Right, okay,
And
good.
I've heard you talk about it before, so that helped. I also understand that the Old Testament, the Jews were a theocracy, at least at some points.
Yes.
And so...
Well, they were always under a theocracy, but they didn't act that way much of the time. So,
and we are not.
Correct.
So I understand that. But so what confuses me, though, is if under the theocracy God was giving them the laws, why aren't some of the laws that were good for them, why would they not be good for us? And the extreme that, you know, when you're discussing this with people, is someone says, oh, so should we kill homosexuals now? Should we kill people who sleep with their mother, or you know, whatever, some of those
sure.
very strange laws. And I don't know if I have a good answer for why that, you know, if it was good for them then,
right.
and that was something God wanted, what's the piece I'm missing when I think through why it's,
right.
Why I would object to that now, why I would say, well, no, of course we shouldn't kill
okay, them. Let me try to give you an answer, and I actually jotted down three different points here okay. that might help you work through this. And in my response is largely grounded in Fruchtenbaum's analysis, which is my own view, but I thought he just said it with particular clarity, and I'm referring to it here because there's others that may not know about it, and you've already read it, but they can look it up. So here's the first principle when you go to the Old Testament. If there is a moral command that is given, you ask the question, who is the directive given to? All right, that's the first question. The command is morally obligatory upon the person to whom it was given. So when God tells David to do something, David has to do what God tells him to do because he's David and God's telling David. But that only applies to David as David. So whatever God told David to do doesn't mean that we have to do it because it was a command given to David. If there's a command given to Israel, then Israel has to do that. Not Gentiles necessarily, but certainly Israel is obliged to do that because that's a command God gave to Israel. If God gives a command to mankind, then that is a command that all human beings have to obey. And so our very first question is, given any command, to whom is the command given? Now, when it comes to the Mosaic Law is given to Israel. That's why it's called the Mosaic Law. And in fact, when you read in Deuteronomy, for example, when the law is given a second time, Deuteronomos, second law, this is at the end of the wanderings before they just come into the promised land, God explains the nature of this agreement he's having with Israel. And he says, listen, I saved you, so you're mine, and I will protect you if you obey me. Here are my rules. If you follow these rules, everything will go fine. You will pay taxes to me, the tithe. You will, I conscript you into my army, but I will guard you and I will protect you. However, if you disobey, look out. I remove my protection and the rest of the world can have at you. That's basically what's going on there. And then he gives the body of information, the laws, by which they are to comport themselves and by which their theocracy is now defined. So all of those laws are laws for Israel. They are given to Israel, and Israel has to obey them until they're rescinded. They are not given to Gentiles. The Mosaic Law is not given to Gentiles. And this is why Fruchtenbaum, I think it's Fruchtenbaum, that's not Fruchtenstein, is it? It's Fruchtenbaum, right. Anyway, this is why he says whenever you read the law, you have to read the law over the shoulder of an Israeli or a Jew, a Hebrew, because it's their mail, it's not ours. All right? Now, when it comes to the law, say the commandment against murder, yes, that commandment is given against with regards to the Jews, but it's also given with regards to all mankind in chapter 9 of Genesis. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God, God created man. So there you have the an implicit prohibition against murder and an implicit application, or rather explicit application of capital punishment for capital crimes. That is given to mankind. So here you see a principle given to mankind, which is also given specifically to a nation of people. We don't keep that prohibition because it was given to the Jews. We give it because it was given to all people. Are you with me so far?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the first question is, who were the laws given to? Secondly, we have to ask, with regards to any of those laws, since it may be that even though there were laws given to Jews, it may be that they have application to us now, who are not Jews under the theocracy. Murdered, the law against murder does, and we know that from other texts. But it might be that we can reason from the nature of the law itself by reflection to see if it may be a transcendent principle or something applied just to them. So the second question is, does any prohibition given to the group of people or to an individual seem to have a transcendent quality? And this is just a matter of reflection. So if the Jews are not supposed to steal, this implies private property. But clearly, Jews aren't the only people who have property ownership. Non-Jews have property ownership. And if it's wrong for Jews to violate property ownership, it seems it's probably wrong for anybody to violate property ownership. So by reflecting on some of these principles, we can come to the conclusion that the reason that this principle is in the law to the Jews is because it is also a law for everybody. Are you with me so far?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now, this is a deliberative process. It's not foolproof. But I think we can do a pretty good job there. When the scripture says to the Jews that you shouldn't eat shellfish, people may argue about this, but it doesn't strike me that there is a transcendent moral principle involved there, or that you shouldn't have two different fibers mixed in with each other. Now, what about the question? What about the question of homosexuality and executing homosexuals? Well, we can use the same principle there. The Jews were told homosexuality was wrong, and there should be a punishment for it in their political system. That punishment was execution. But here is the reason that it said that homosexuality was wrong. It said there, if any man lies with a man as he does with a woman, this is an abomination, and he shall be executed. Now, let's just put the punishment aside for a moment, Scott. Do you think that the way this is characterized gives us good reason to believe that whether a Jew or a Gentile lies with a man as he does with a woman, it is still an abomination?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. There seems to be a suggestion that there's a violation of a natural order that really matters to God. Okay? Not only that, in Leviticus, where it talks about some of these prohibitions, it actually says, the people who came before you did these things, and that's why I wiped them out. And you shouldn't do them, nor the alien that lives with you. So these are more indications from the text, if we're willing to take our time and just read a little bit, do our homework, instead of jumping on a slogan bandwagons, as some people do, we can see that there are some reasons why it seems legitimate to believe that at least the conduct is transcendently immoral. Now, it does remain a further question as to whether, how and whether or not we punish that in a Gentile culture or not. And I think that's a different issue. Because God required execution under the theocracy, does that mean he requires execution in a Gentile environment, even though it still seems it would be wrong? And my response is no, I don't think that requires that. But do you see how I've separated the moral issue, which seems to be transcendent, from the judicial issue, which seems to be germane just to the nation of Israel?
Yes.
Okay,
but
good.
I think that's where I get tripped up, because if someone is asking me, but so why wouldn't you advocate that now, Scott? If you're wanting this, you know, your nation to be a Christian nation or what have you, why wouldn't you advocate it? If God thought that was a good idea for them, why would it not be a good idea for you? And, of course, I want to say, well, that just seems, you know, wrong. But I don't have...
Okay, let me tell you a little bit about why God made the peculiar laws that he did in Israel. If you look in the book of Ephesians, well, first of all, what was the purpose for Israel? Israel was a nation called by God through Abraham to be the source of salvation for the world, and ultimately that would be the Messiah. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay, so what happens if this, in a sense, missionary nation becomes deeply morally corrupted and compromised? Will it be able to fulfill God's mission?
Not well.
No. So you have all kinds of laws that are built in that are meant to build a wall around Israel to protect them from becoming involved in the practices and religious beliefs of other cultures, so that they would be not changed by them and would be allowed then to fulfill their mission. This is not the same situation with Gentiles. So that's why keeping the Sabbath and children obeying their parents and all the punishments pertaining to that and homosexuality and all of these things that the other countries did that God didn't want Israel to do because they had a special mission, he made laws to make sure that if they obeyed them, this wouldn't take place in Israel. This is not the same mission for Gentiles. Is homosexuality wrong? Yes, but there is no – the reason that I think that God had the severe punishment them does not apply to us now. And therefore, we don't use that severe punishment. And so that allows me to make this distinction. By the way, this is why it said don't put the two different fabrics of clothing together. That seems weird. That is a kind of a picture of not mixing your cultures together. And in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul talks about when Jesus came, he broke down the dividing wall between Jew and Gentile. The wall was the law. And so you see in the law a lot of things that were meant to keep people culturally distinct. Okay? I got one more point to make, so I don't want to go too much detail on this. But you see the point that I'm making here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so there are peculiarities to the Hebrew law that had to do with the Jews and their mission, which is why we have to be careful that we just don't pick and choose willy-nilly. But we think through why some things might apply and some wouldn't. Okay? So the first question is you look at which... To whom was the law given? Those who, to whom it's given are obliged by it, and those it's not given to may not be obliged by it, depending on other factors. So what would be other factors? Well, you have to reflect on it and see, does it seem like this is a transcendent moral concept based on the reasoning given in the text or just by our own moral reflection or not? That would help us to know. Here's the third thing that will help us, though, in that deliberation, and that is asking, does the New Testament have anything to say about this? Because the New Testament was not written to Jews in a theocracy. It was written to Christians, largely Gentile Christians, who were not under a theocracy. It turns out, by the way, that every prohibition of the Ten Commandments, or every command regarding in the Ten Commandments, save one, is repeated for Gentiles in the New Testament. And the one that's not repeated is the command regarding the Sabbath. So it seems that Paul and the others who write about those things they do in the New Testament are giving us information of moral obligations that may or may not be in the Mosaic Law, but if they are, they apply to even to Gentiles because they're transcendent in nature, and their writing gives us some insight there. If you look at Romans 1, for example, Paul there is talking about general revelation, and there he talks about homosexuality. And he explains why homosexuality is evil before God. It's because God gave men women to function sexually with. And they abandoned the women God gave them and instead burned with sexual desire towards each other. And this brought the condemnation of God. So see, you've got a rationale there. Now, whether people agree with him or not is a different issue. The point I'm making is there is an example in the New Testament where a rationale is given about why something is wrong, even for Gentiles outside of the theocracy, that was also identified as wrong for Jews inside of the theocracy. So basically, you have three steps. And does this sound tedious? Yeah, I guess it is a little bit, but sometimes it takes a little work to try to accurately understand what the text is saying. The first one is look to whom the law is given. Secondly, ask whether for those to whom it's not directly given, is there a transcendent moral principle built in here somewhere or expressed here that might apply to everybody? And thirdly, does the New Testament weigh in on it to give more clarification regarding this thing? Now, my suspicion is if you follow those three steps, you're going to do a pretty good job of being able to figure out what in the Old Testament applies in the New Testament economy. What do you think?
Very helpful. You're very good at what you do.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. I hope that makes it clear for you and for others that are listening. Got to run to break right now, and I'll be back with more of your calls and questions at 1-800-227-5278. Lines open there. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Give us a call on Stand to Reason. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today on the show that's not for everyone.
because sometimes it hurts to have to think. And by the way, that last question, it was an excellent question, underscoring how it's necessary sometimes to have to think things through to come to right answers about, in this case, the relationship of the Old Testament law and New Testament conduct. And people say, well, if you're against homosexuality, why aren't you executing them? You want to pick and choose. You still eat shellfish, don't you? You're just picking and choosing. And the answer is, yes, we are picking and choosing. But we're not picking and choosing in an arbitrary fashion, not if we're being careful and doing it right. We are picking and choosing based on good reasons to see what does apply from the Jewish law to us, because the rules there have transcendent moral value, moral significance, and which ones don't. And sometimes there could be it still is wrong, New Testament or Old Testament, to disobey your parents, but in the Old Testament economy, they executed disobedient kids, and we don't do that now. And there's a reason why they did it then. So just because we don't follow the same jurisprudence on the issue doesn't mean the thing ain't an issue. It still is an issue. It's still wrong to disobey your parents, and it's still, homosexuality is still wrong, too. And both of those, by the way, the New Testament weighs in on as a moral issue, even though it doesn't prescribe the same punishments for Gentile cultures for those. By the way, we're not the only ones who pick and choose. When people quote the Old Testament, it's particularly from the book of Amos and others like that, about how we are supposed to care for the poor. I think we do have an obligation as individuals to do so, and as God's community to do so, though not as a government, at least in my opinion. I don't think that's the way that works. The government doesn't redistribute wealth for that. That's not justified in most cases. But in any event, when they go to places in the Old Testament and talk about that, in their mind, they think that applies to us now, even though they wouldn't promote actions against homosexuals like executing them. So everybody picks and chooses. The question really is, what are the principles by which you pick and choose, and are those principles licit or not? I have given three of those principles to our last caller, and I think they're good ones, at least to get the ball rolling. Let's go to Temecula and Karen. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Karen.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Long time listener here, and listen to you when I work out at the gym on my MP3.
Oh, great.
So I exercise my body and mind at the same time.
Good for you.
And I probably burn a lot more calories that way.
Yeah, and it makes your brain cells grow.
Exactly. I heard you say one time, and I was driving in the car, and I couldn't write it down, but you were expressing a way that you might invite someone to examine the evidence with you sort of on a longer-term basis. And you said something, and I just loved just the way you put it. And it was something about, you know, how about if we over pizza, blah, blah, blah. And I don't remember how you put it.
That's always difficult for me to respond to a question like that. You said this wonderful thing that was really great, but I can't remember what it was. Can you tell me again? And the problem is I don't know exactly. I can't remember exactly what I said. And there are some things that I say with frequency, and they become aphorisms for me. And so I can recall them and say them over and over again,
right,
because they're little kind of rules in my behavior. Other times I kind of just come up with something, and it seems to stick with someone like it did with you. At least it impressed you. But the actual words didn't stick with you or with me.
Right.
Now, if you can tell me a little bit more about that, I might be able to come up with something again. But
I think perhaps if you think about a situation where, you know, someone might just be open,
right,
and you want to invite them to, I don't know whether you would invite them to for like a series or,
mm-hmm,
you know, sort of something like that. And it's kind of like, hey, if you really want to see, you
mm-hmm
know, or if you...
You want to dig into it and find out for yourself. Maybe
yeah
this. Okay, let me. Here's what I was thinking about this actually a little bit when I saw the question come up. So let me tell you what came to mind.
Mm-hmm.
If I had somebody that wanted to talk about Christianity or the Christian worldview as to whether it was true or not,
mm-hmm,
but they're kind of starting from ground zero. But they're open. They're seeking, and this word seeker, I think, is overused and misused much of the time. But let's just say, for the sake of discussion, they are genuinely seeking and open, and they want to hear the case.
Mm-hmm.
I would have three main things that I'd want to focus in on. And the first one is God, whether or not there is a God. This is, by the way, I call a two-step approach, even though I have 3 points. The two-step approach is you start with God first, and then you go to Jesus. The one-step approach is you start with Jesus. But if somebody's just, you know, sometimes people already know about God, or maybe you can start with Jesus and then they start believing about God when they believe Jesus. But I'm going to give you the two-step approach. So we start at the beginning, and I'd want to talk about whether or not there's good reason to believe that God exists. Mm-hmm. And then I would talk, I would personally use the cosmological argument, that is, and I think this is the simplest argument to use, to show that believing in God is not only reasonable, but it's the odds-on favorite option. And the cosmological argument is simply an observation based on the existence of the cosmos, that there must be something that caused it that's adequate to cause it. So if the universe came into existence, what caused the universe and the whole natural realm to come into existence? Now, we know the universe came into existence. So whatever caused it to come into existence had to be outside of the natural universe. So it had to be either supernatural or supranatural, above the natural world. And it had to be a cause, since the universe is an effect, it had to be a cause that was adequate to the effect. It's like when somebody knocks on the door, you say, what was that? What caused that? You don't say nothing. You say, someone knocked on the door. Go answer it. You probably wouldn't say, that's the wind, especially if it was a kind of knock, you know, da-da-da-da-da, because that seems like it's designed. In any event, it would be unlikely that it would be nothing. It would be likely that it was someone knocking, and therefore you answer the door. It's a common sense illustration. If the universe comes into existence, there must have been something that caused it to, or probably someone, because something is not going to be adequate to make the kind of universe that we have discovered. So that there is a universe, especially a universe with what appearance of design, and it seems to be a universe thick with morality, right and wrong as it applies to human beings, that requires an explanation, and it seems like the best explanation going is that there is a God who created such a universe and designed it in that way, and that this God cares about morality for human beings, and that's why he built the universe the way he did. Now, I think that makes sense. There are rejoinders, there are alternatives, but I don't think any alternative makes as much sense. That's why I think it not only makes sense, but it's the odds-on favorite. Mm-hmm. So the reasonable person would say, yeah, I guess God, it is good reason to believe God exists. Okay, now if he existed, now I want to move from God and I want to move to man. And here, notice that we're not opening up any scriptures or anything at this point. We're just reflecting. There are two things I want people to notice about human beings that are central to the Christian worldview. We already talked about God is central to the Christian worldview. And since God is central to the worldview and it seems to make sense that something like that God does exist, then it seems that Christianity is true at that point. First step. Second step, what do we know about man? And there are 2 points here that I'd want to emphasize. First is that there's something special about human beings. This is why we gas termites, but not human beings, you know, not people. This is why in every culture there are laws against murder, unjustified killing of human beings. This is why we don't act like animals, or we're not supposed to. We already know this. Now, there might be some debate about what justified killing is, but that's still that killing human beings requires justification is a culture is a view that every culture holds. So we have this innate sense that humans are special and made for something. If they get cut down when they're young in life, they this is tragic. They have an untimely death. They died before their time. So this is language that seems to suggest that we already know that human beings are special and they're noble and they're beautiful. And we see great acts of goodness and kindness and great acts of nobility and great works of art and beauty and things like that human beings produce. So there's a nobility about human beings. But the second thing we have to notice is that in spite of the specialness and nobility of human beings, there's this terrible cruelty. Something's wrong with us. We're broken. And the way we're broken is moral, and that's why we feel guilt about things in our life. And I suspect we feel guilty because we are guilty. So this, both of these things are actually central to the Christian worldview. God created human beings in his image. That's what makes them noble. But because they rebelled against God, now they're broken and fallen, and they're trying to get back to God. Now, notice what I'm trying to do here, Karen. I'm trying to think together, reason together with a person by reflecting on the nature of the world before we even take any revelation. Mm-hmm. And see, what we can we discover that's true about the world that fits the description that the Bible and Christianity gives about the world? Now, if there's a fit between the world and what Christianity says, at least at that point, Christianity is true. If there's reason to believe there is a God and Christianity says there's a God, well, then Christianity is true at that point. If there's a reason to believe that human beings are special but they're broken, and Christianity says they're special and they're broken for these reasons, then Christianity is true at that point. So we have these connectors between the claims of Christianity and reality that are like truth connectors. Okay, now what do? We have God making man in his image, man distant from God, separated from trying to get back, and man being aware that he's special, but he's broken and he's guilty. And of course, the feelings of guilt is the awareness that we deserve to be punished for what we did wrong. Now what? Rescue. This is where Jesus comes in. God came to earth in a human being in order to rescue men and restore them to God. And the way he did that is to teach them about God and to take punishment for man's sin on himself so men could be forgiven and restored to God. So now the focus in this third step of reasoning, this third piece of the Christian worldview, is Jesus. So our three steps are God, than man, than Jesus. Notice how we're going from the more general to the more specific to the most specific. And now we ask, who is Jesus? What did he do? Can we trust that he was right? And now the focus is on Jesus. Is he the man he claimed to be? You might want to talk about the historical record and the Gospels being accurate. We're not talking about whether the Bible's inspired by God. We're just asking whether the record of Jesus' life is historically reliable. And if it is, even in the broad strokes of the life of Christ, then we have this miracle-working man who claimed to be God, who also claimed to be a source of salvation. That, in a nutshell, is the Christian worldview. Now, there's more, but, I mean, this is like the foundation. And I think all three of those points, from the more general to the more specific, turn out to be compelling to this genuine seeker to demonstrate that the Christian worldview fits the way the world really is, and it really is tied together in the person of Jesus. Now, if you want to know how that all is tied together, what I've written a piece like 3 or 4 years ago when the movie came out on the Passion of the Christ. And the piece is entitled The Christ of the Passion, What the Movie Couldn't Show. It's a past issue of Solid Ground, our newsletter. So if you go to str.org and under the drop-down menus under resources, you'll see Solid Ground Archives. And then just go back, I think it's 2004, March, April 2004, something like that. There it is, the Jesus of the Passion, and you can select that and read it. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a little bit more substance about how Jesus solved this problem to restore man with God. But again, I don't remember what it was that I said that seemed so clever to you at the moment. Mm-hmm. But if I were to sit down now with somebody who is a seeker, I would want to cover these three points. And I think I can show that each of the points, which points are central to the Christian view of the world, turn out to be not only reasonable points, but compelling points. Mm-hmm. And that leaves them then with thinking about Jesus, which is right where I want to leave them. And at this point, I might give them a Gospel of John. I said, now, with all this in mind, I want you to read John, the Gospel of John, and let Jesus and his followers speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And you know how John starts. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He created everything. He was the light of the world. He became a man. The world didn't see him as that, but he was God incarnate, basically, is what John says there in his prologue, and then he gets right into the life of Christ. And I think that would be a suitable follow-up and for a person then to read the Gospel of John and then see this glorious life of Jesus.
That makes terrific sense. I think another way that I could word my question is if a, you know, you're talking with someone and they bring up an objection, and, you know, of course we all notice that everyone has heard of all the objections, and that so many times we can gain a lot more ground if instead of constantly dealing with the, you know, picayune objections, that we move them to, okay, yeah, those objections are out there. Have you ever considered the evidence in favor of, you know what I mean?
Good for you.
And so it was sort of like I liked the manner in which it was sort of an invitation to, okay, now let's maybe consider, the evidence in favor of. Then we come back and look at the objections in light of the broader picture.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you think about Lee Strobel's writings, his first book was The Case for The Case for Christ, and his second was The Case for Faith. I mean, it's hard to answer objections to the Christian worldview if people don't actually understand what that is in a little more holistic sense. But once they do, sometimes the objections, some of them fade away, but there's still going to be legitimate objections. Why is Jesus the only way, for example? What about the problem of evil? And so, therefore, Lee's second book deals with that. I hope you have both of them in your library because they're very useful in that regard. But that general approach that he takes is the same one you're describing.
Okay.
And I do think sometimes we're spinning our wheels trying to answer objections when it might be better to sit down with somebody and spend a little time helping them to understand what our view is first before we do that. Most of the time when people are firing objections, it's because they're not really willing to listen to the worldview as it is. But if a person is willing to have a couple of nights over pizza or whatever and go through those things, then I think that would be great. As long as one is equipped to give those basic pieces of information. And we have, you know, I've just outlined this for you and the details on our website of different things I think will help fill in the blanks there. By the way, I mentioned Strobel's Case for Faith, which is answering the challenges. Both The Case for Christ and Case for Faith are now in DVD form. And it'd be great to sit down with someone and just watch this. This will do some work for you.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, and I mean, for those who maybe aren't so sure about whether they can cover all the ground, this might be a way of starting. And the bonus is, though I wasn't one of the people featured in the Case for Faith books, I was actually featured in the Case for Faith DVD fairly prominently in dealing with both questions, the problem of evil and why Jesus is the only way. So I think I actually think that they made me look better than my contribution because of a really good way they told the story with the different experts, as it were. But I want to commend that to you. I think, and both of them are out in DVD in the Case for Faith just recently. So I want to commend that to you. I got to run. Go to break, though. Karen, thanks so much for your call. And we'll be taking more callers in just a minute. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Basic training for your mind, ladies and gentlemen. That's Stand to Reason, and I'm Greg Kokel. Glad you've joined me here in our final segment. By the way, don't forget next Sunday, a week from today, October 26th, free seminar. That's F-R-E-E, free seminar on intelligent design, entitled Understanding Intelligent Design, Everything You Need to Know in Plain Language. And authors William Dembski and Sean McDowell will be the major presenters at that conference starting 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. That'll be 2 hours right after the show here in Southern California, San Juan Capistrano, Capo Valley Church there. If you want more information, just go to cvcs.org. That would be cvcs.org, and you will get everything you need to know about when, where, why, how, and all the skinny on the Understanding Intelligent Design Conference next Sunday, October 26th at 6 to 8 p.m. All right, time to get back to callers. Let's see. All right, let's move quickly here. And Kenneth in Irvine, California, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hey, Greg, how are you doing?
Okay, good.
Right on. Yeah, I was just listening.
I haven't heard right on for a long time. That's kind of refreshing. Kind of reminds me of the 60s.
Right on.
All right.
I was listening to a caller a few minutes ago, and you were going over, you're discussing the commandments being iterated in the New Testament.
Yeah, that was Scott from Dallas, Texas, right?
Right. And you had mentioned that maybe you want to clarify exactly what you said, but basically what I understood was that the Sabbath was basically not reiterated as the other nine commandments were.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it simply isn't. I mean, it's kind of a matter of descriptive fact. It's not reiterated. Some will suggest that it was just assumed to be the case. You know, I'm not convinced by that. And there does seem to be some passages that seem to speak against Sabbath observance. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Colossians chapter 2, for example, where it says some people consider some days over the others and some consider every day alike, you know. So, and the practice of the New Testament was to meet on Sundays, a New Testament church to meet on Sundays, not on Saturdays, which was the Sabbath observance. So, they had a regular meeting day, but that was a different day than Sabbath. And there was the gathering together, but I don't think it came with the same kind of obligation that Sabbath keeping came to for the Jews.
Okay, when in Mark 2, I have a few passages marked in my Bible.
All right.
I don't know how many we're going to have time to get to, but I guess the first one is in Mark 2, mm-hmm. Starting at verse 23 to 28, and it's basically when Christ's disciples, well, before that, previously, Christ's disciples are basically being accused of breaking the Sabbath because they're going through the field plucking hemp.
Right,
ground.
Uh-huh.
And so at the end of it all, Christ says, you know, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath.
Right.
And the Sabbath is made for man and not man for the Sabbath.
That's right.
How would you go about explaining that passage?
In the case of the Gospels, for some people this might be sounds like theological nitpicking, but it's not at all. It is a significant distinction I want to make here.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews were under the theocracy until the initiation of the New Covenant.
Okay.
Once the New Covenant was initiated, then it was a different covenant that applied. And the new covenant is described, you know, is described first in Jeremiah 31:31 and following. And it says, I'm going to make a new, the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with you, not like the one I made with you when you came out of Sinai, the one with you, which you broke. That's the Mosaic covenant.
Yeah.
but a new covenant, right? Laws in the heart and that kind of stuff. Now, remember when Jesus was at the Last Supper, he says, this is the blood of the what?
The new
and everlasting covenant, which is shed for the forgiveness of sins. Right. Jesus shed his blood the next day on the cross, and the other provision of the new covenant was the giving of the Spirit, which happened 40 days after the ascension.
That's right.
So Pentecost. So I think it's safe to say that either from the time of the cross or from the time of Pentecost, you have the beginning of the new covenant period. But prior to that, you had all the provisions of the old covenant. So you would expect in the Gospels, even though there was an anticipation of the new covenant coming, that at the time the Jews were still supposed to do what the law said. And in fact, in Matthew 24, you see that very thing. Matthew 23. I'm going in the wrong direction. If I go back a few pages there, Matthew, Mark. Yeah, that's how that works, Greg. Matthew, Mark, chapter 23. At the beginning of the chapter, this is where Jesus is laying on the woes to the Jews. It says, Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. They're speaking for Moses. Okay, verse 3, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to those deeds, their deeds. So when they teach you Moses, obey Moses, but don't act like they act. Okay, so as Jews, they are to live according to the laws pertaining to the Jews. Notice that this is given in the Old Testament economy, because later on in Pentecost, in the New Testament, the teaching then is clearly that the Gentiles don't have to keep the law, and even the Jews, it seemed, didn't have to keep the law the same way because they were under a different economy. So any references to Sabbath keeping in the Gospels would be properly included under the Old Testament section. Even though they're part of our New Testament, it's an Old Testament economy.
Okay.
And that's how I would explain that.
Okay.
When you get to Colossians, of course, you have a different situation. And that's where it says in Colossians 2 that, he says, don't keep going along with decrees that says do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These aren't things that help. And it seems like he's referring to Old Testament prohibitions there that really don't have anything to do with godliness. Go ahead.
As far as what you just commented on, do not taste, do not handle, do not touch, it calls those things traditions of men. So I would disagree that those were statutes.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, fair enough. Okay, but does that make sense, what I've said so far?
Overall, I hear what you're saying. There's a few things that I want to inject, though. As far as what was being taught to Jews, after the new covenant had been instituted to the masses, there was an instance in Acts when Paul was being accused of teaching Jews to forsake the law of Moses. And so what he did in response was he purified himself. Some people think that this was the Nazaretic vow.
Right,
Of it.
Right.
And he did this to demonstrate that, in fact, that he was not teaching to forsake the law of Moses, but that he himself kept the commandments.
Yeah, I actually don't think that's what was going on, because he had, and here's why, and I'll have to move to a next caller right after I finish this, but he had someone with him when he did this. Do you know who that was?
I do not recall.
It was Timothy.
Okay.
Was Timothy a Jew or a Greek?
Timothy was, he was circumcised, he was a Greek.
He was a Greek, but Paul had him circumcised.
Right.
In the manner of the Jews.
Right.
Though he was a Greek. Now, do you remember when Paul said, I do all things for all, I become all things to all men in order that by all means I might win some. To the Jews, this is his explanation, his pattern. To the Jews, I become as under the law, though I am not under the law.
But he says right after that, but I am under the law of Christ.
Yes, the law of Christ, not the law of Moses. So the love of Christ is different. So you see the point I'm making. I think that gives the rationale for why he did what he did in Jerusalem. He was trying to be as much like them as possible culturally, even making the Gentile look like them, though he wasn't a Jew. He and the Gentile were becoming Jews for the sake of winning the Jews. And so I think that helps explain. I'm going to have to run on that one, Kenneth. Thank you so much for the call. I want to get to Shane in, is that somewhere in Virginia? Let me get the button here, Shane. There you go. Shane in, Blacksburg, Virginia?
Blacksburg, Virginia, yeah. So,
glad to have you, Shane. What's up?
Well, I've been in dialogue with a materialist friend regarding the resurrection of Jesus. I've been trying to make the case for the resurrection.
Okay.
And he asked me, why am I choosing to investigate this one extraordinary claim of antiquity out of the vast sea of extraordinary claims of antiquity?
Yeah.
That leads me to my question to you. Do we have an obligation to investigate all extraordinary or, let's say, supernatural claims antiquity?
I don't know why we would. The reason that this one's so important is because it's central to the theological claims of Christianity. That is, if this claim is false, then the theological claims are false. And if this claim is true, then I think you're well within your rights, the claim to the resurrection, then you're well within your rights to believe that that it substantiates the other claims, theological claims that Jesus made. So one is not, I think, they are not obliged to check out every single claim of supernaturalism. When you have a decisive claim available to you that has decisive evidence in favor of it. Do you see the distinction I'm making?
I think so.
Well, let me just put it differently. Somebody said, the claim is that Jesus did all these extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it this way. Let's forget about the past for the moment. Let's put Jesus in the present.
Okay.
Let's just say he's here. You hear him claim to be God in a way that is understandable to us in our culture. He didn't say it quite that way in that culture. He said it a different way in the way they understood to be a claim to divinity, and that is he claimed to be the Son of God. But it was that kind of claim. In this culture, he would make that claim. He would say, you know, I'm God. So he claims to be God, and then we see him do the kinds of things that any man who was God would probably be able to do. He controls the forces of nature. We see him do this. He multiplies food. He controls the spiritual realm by casting out demons. He can take sick or blind or lame people and restore them at a word. Let's just say all of this actually happens.
Okay.
He raises people from the dead. He then tells you that when he is killed without cause by his enemies, he will come alive again 3 days later. Then he was and he does. He was killed and he does come back 3 days later and you see him. So let's just say these are, I'm putting you in the same time frame as him so you can see these are actual facts. Or we are stipulating that they're facts. If all of those things were true, if he did all of those things, would it be reasonable to conclude that his claim to divinity and his claim to be the solution to man's problem is well justified in light of the acts of power that he's been doing, including his resurrection?
Yes.
Okay, in the face of that barrage of evidence, why would it be necessary to figure out whether some witch doctor in Africa turned some, you know, rock into gold or not? I don't see why that's even necessary to go there.
Okay.
And so that's why, now, I stipulated you're there and you see them true. I think that the evidence of history can demonstrate that those things actually did happen. And if they actually did happen, we have good reason to believe that, then it renders these other things somewhat inconsequential. Unless we have a powerful competing claim with powerful competing evidence, then we have to weigh the two of them. Anyway, that's the best I can do in a few minutes there, Shane. I hope it's helpful. Glad to talk to you, though, and thank you for calling, and the same to the rest of you. Here's your homework this week. Go to str.org, and the featured article is Marriage is a Social Construction. Of course, I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing against that. It relates to the whole issue of same-sex marriage. Check it out, Marriage is a Social Construction, str.org. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining me today. You go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.